Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
The information depicted in this podcast is purely for informational purposes only. Please consult your healthcare professional before making any changes to your lifestyle or routine.
Hey everyone, and welcome to the Boost Your Biology podcast. My name is Lucas, and I'm the founder of Ergogenic Health. Together in this podcast series, we will go underground to explore cutting-edge health and human performance insights that you simply cannot search on Google to help you upgrade your existence. So, without any further ado, let's jump into today's episode. Alrighty, everyone, welcome to yet another episode of the Boost Your Biology podcast. Today, I'm joined in by a special guest whom I've been keeping an eye on with his content over the last few months in particular, because the sort of stuff that he posts is very much up my alley, and he definitely sort of speaks my language. So I really want to welcome Gage to the show. So welcome, Gage.
Hi, thank you for inviting me. This is pretty awesome. So I really do hope that the echo isn't happening, but I think it's not, I guess. So my name is Gage. I am a blogger, writer, kind of a researcher in a way, maybe an independent researcher or something like that. I got into it, kind of was just curious about things at first, like if I had like symptoms or if I got like prescribed medication or something, I would just get like really curious, and then I would like take it really far, and then I started wanting to understand more like consciousness in general. And then I kind of like started to do things like I would try all these different nootropics and try to kind of like build this kind of a map of the receptors and what they do to each other and to your body and your brain and all that kind of stuff.
Mm. Yeah, I find when you end up going, like exploring a couple of these like receptors and neurotransmitter pathways, you end up just going down a massive rabbit hole, and you end up like snowball searching where you're just like, you end up in just no man's land sort of thing. So maybe we can sort of start out by giving our listeners insight into what you enjoy researching.
Sure, yeah. One of the most kind of central things has been Dynorphin, which is, it is the, so I don't know how technical I should get. I sometimes have a problem with being too technical, but I'm going to try to make it like a mix of technical and broad at the same time. But it is basically the body's own, if you've heard of the drug Salvia, that is very similar to Dynorphin. Dynorphin binds as an agonist to the kappa opioid receptors, which are, unlike the other opioid receptors, they are dysphoric, actually. And I've kind of just rabbit-holed a lot on that topic. And I've also explored a lot into like psychedelics and schizophrenia, bipolar disorder. And I kind of think that, so like a lot of people think that psychedelics are really a bad thing for schizophrenia. I don't actually think that. I think that they might actually treat schizophrenia instead. And so like some of my like really big projects, like especially Dynorphin Theory, has focused a little bit on that, like kind of suggesting that schizophrenia is not necessarily like psychedelics, although there might be some people that are probably like that naturally. But I think most people that are experiencing like schizophrenic symptoms are probably more like the drug Salvia, which I think people tend to kind of just lump together all these like hallucinogens, if you want to call them that, together. But they're not really that similar. Their mechanisms differ. They have some different correlates and stuff like that. Like, for example, and stop me if I go too far, by the way.
Yeah, that's okay.
So like with Dynorphin, or like let's say like Salvia, the mechanism that it stimulates, it suppresses glutamate activity, and I think that's like one of the big ways that it probably impacts perception. And that's different from something like LSD or psilocybin, which would actually increase glutamate release in some parts of the brain, like the prefrontal cortex. And so Salvia, if assuming that it does what kappa opioid receptors do, I don't remember if I found specific studies talking about Salvia doing this, but the kappa opioid receptor stimulation suppresses glutamate release, which kind of makes it in a way similar to like dissociatives, like ketamine, or PCP or something like that. Those drugs still are different though, because they also increase glutamate release indirectly. So that's like a way that dissociatives and psychedelics, like things like ketamine, overlap with LSD in that way, is that they probably like get the mind like really ramped up, especially dose dependently, probably at a higher dose. I think ketamine would probably start to look more like Salvia probably.
Yeah. Maybe what we might do is just for my listeners, cause they definitely don't have this degree of understanding. So maybe we'll sort of backtrack a little bit and give our listeners a bit of an insight into what, like there are many different types of opioid receptors and we're specifically discussing the kappa opioid receptor. And for them, I think the best way that they can potentially relate to it is the commonly used nootropic lion's mane, which potentially contains a mild kappa opioid agonist. Whether or not that's true outside the in vivo studies, that's a different story. But maybe how can we sort of discuss the link between potentially exercise and even sauna use to the kappa opioid network?
Yeah. So I didn't actually know that about lion's mane. That's really interesting. I don't think I've tried. I think I might have tried it once. But anyways, so I guess we could start with, okay, so there are like three major types of opioid receptors. There's like the mu opioid receptor, which is kind of classically known for being euphoric. That is like the thing that people would think with like heroin or codeine or Vicodin or whatever. And then there's the delta opioid receptor, which is kind of ignored by a lot of people, I think, but it's probably more similar to the mu opioid receptor. Like a lot of the things that it does tend to kind of support the same mechanisms as the mu opioid receptor. But then the kappa opioid receptor is very much different. It does very opposite things compared to mu opioid receptors, especially. So for example, mu opioid receptors can stimulate like dopamine activity and be probably pretty motivating and stuff like that. But kappa opioid receptors suppress dopamine release. So it's actually like the opposite. And there's like a ton of opposites with these two systems, like from the fact of like mu opioids being euphoric and then kappa opioids being dysphoric. The same is true for like anxiety. The kappa opioid receptor is like anxious. It's linked to like PTSD. It is linked to aversion learning. So like learning to kind of, be afraid of things, to avoid things, to have an aversive reaction to things. And then on the opposite end, the mu opioids, they kind of reinforce everything. They make you more likely to repeat things. So like if you were like take something like Vicodin while you're doing like say exercise or something, you could probably end up finding yourself more I don't know if I would say addicted to exercising, but you might tend to start craving it. Like in the same way that people might crave the opioid drugs, that you can probably link that craving to like a bunch of different stuff. I don't recommend doing that, of course, because that gets into weird things. But then with kappa opioids, it would be the opposite. Like if you were to take salvia in your room, I think that it would lead to becoming less comfortable in general in your room, which is kind of weird. I don't know if that's true, but I suspect that that's probably what will happen. Like if you kept dosing, you'd probably start to feel uncomfortable every time you entered that space. And people report like really bad experiences with salvia, but there are some people that report not like kind of neutral experiences too. And then you mentioned saunas. That's kind of interesting because saunas, I've heard that they increase dynorphin activity. And I think the reason, so like one of the things that dynorphin does is lowers body temperature. So it can actually induce hypothermia. And so when you're in a sauna, I'm guessing that what happens is probably that your body is trying to compensate for the heat and it's releasing that. And that could have benefits. Like you could be desensitizing the dynorphin effects. Like say that you're normally sensitive to heat and it makes you get like side effects. If you go into a sauna, you might actually find that you're like very tolerant of normal temperatures all of a sudden. And probably you'll have like a mood boost because there's no dynorphin trying to compensate for like the heat anymore. And kind of on the opposite end again, the mu opioid system seems to be able to induce fever. And that's kind of an interesting thing. And it gets even weirder. And I don't know like the reasons behind this yet totally, but the fever mechanism connects to the same mechanism as LSD's main target. So that's like really weird. And like, that probably ties into the way that people will like take LSD to quit addictions. Mm. And I don't know if that's the reason for treating the addictions though. Like that, there's like multiple ways that it could probably achieve that effect. And there's like other receptors that have been researched that are linked to suppressing like the withdrawal symptoms of morphine.
Right.
So how are we so far? Is this going well?
This is good. This is good. I'll probably bring it back down another notch because it's, I think for my listeners, they probably aren't familiar with some of these opioid pathways, but it's still relevant. I'll try and just simplify it a little bit. So, perhaps we can sort of segue into some of the serotonin receptors because, I mean, I'm someone who's researching them all the time and trying to understand the different subtypes. For my listeners, so basically serotonin is a neurotransmitter that our brains produce, and there are multiple receptor sites in which it can bind to in the brain and also in the gut and other parts of the body. But to understand them, we first have to realize that they are also connected to other neurotransmitter systems. So like the heterodimer of the 5-HT2A and the D2-like receptors. So they're very much linked. So when we try and research and understand these receptor subtypes, it's important to sort of look at how they influence other neurotransmitter systems, because there are many supplements, many drugs and psychedelics that target these same receptors. For example, we know that, let's say St. John's wort, for example, St. John's wort has been shown to upregulate both the 1A, serotonin 1A, 5-HT1A, and also the 5-HT2A receptor. So if we understand where it's being upregulated, and so which region of the brain, because that's also very important, then we can sort of we can use it as a probe to figure out what sort of implications this will have, what sort of behavioral effects these will have, because we know that, and there's a lot of research on how, you know, the 5-HT2A receptor can influence oxytocin, prolactin, cortisol, ACTH, and these are all the hormones that a lot of people will describe in things like adrenal fatigue or anhedonia. So I guess maybe let's start with the 5-HT2A receptor, because I know you've researched that quite a lot. So maybe did you want to explain a little bit about just the receptor itself and potentially some things that can bind to it or influence its activity?
Yeah. So this is probably the most focused on receptor for all of the psychedelic drugs, psilocybin, LSD, and stuff like that. There's also research on like antipsychotics where they either block the receptor or they do what's called inverse agonism, which I recently found out that when you do that, when you do the inverse agonism, it actually increases the number of receptors. Wow. And that gets kind of interesting. Like some researchers think that it's not really the inverse agonism itself that's beneficial. Instead, it's the increasing the receptors that fixes like problems with like schizophrenia or Alzheimer's. So this receptor is studied for cognition and memory too. It seems that stimulating it increases like neuroplasticity, neurogenesis. It seems to suppress dynorphin activity, which is really interesting. That's kind of like that one idea kind of like set me off into a whole bunch of things, like research rabbit holes and stuff.
So you're saying that the 2A receptor actually suppresses that dysphoric opioid, the dynorphin. You're saying that?
Yeah, it seems so, but it's probably like more complicated because like the 1A receptor and the 2C receptor, they all connect to each other. And like with like the 2C receptor, which is kind of like the sibling receptor of the 5-HT2A receptor, it does some opposite things. So there's like research showing that you can suppress like aversion processing in the brain with 5-HT2A stimulation.
So for my listeners, can you explain what aversion what aversion actually is?
Yeah, it's like basically the thing you don't like. Well, I would describe it as like the thing about pain that you don't like. Like if it wasn't aversive, I think it would just feel like a really strong sensation that was neutral. So it's basically like the negative experience of things. And so like pain, fear, anxiety, depression, all of those things would kind of be an aversion based problem for the most part. And then like PTSD, that's like extreme aversion learning. Like if you think of, like I kind of always like to compare addiction and PTSD as being like the opposites. Like addiction is like extreme reinforcement learning. And then PTSD is extreme aversion learning, which it's like one is pleasurable, supposedly, to a point until it becomes horrible, right? Yeah. Addiction, I mean. But and then PTSD is just kind of like the same like scarring of your brain with extreme negative experiences instead of positive. I mean, addiction is a little bit more complicated there because the withdrawals are extremely negative. So it's like a loop of like being traumatized every time you try to stop, in a way. But so with the 2A receptor, it seems to suppress aversion processing. And those studies were done on stuff like MDMA and LSD and like some weird experimental research chemicals. But then the thing with the 2C receptor, which they're both connected and they seem to interact, and I don't understand that part yet. The 2C receptor is linked to PTSD. People who have, or at least I think it was animal studies actually. Animals that have more of the 2C receptors are like really prone to getting traumatic behavioral expressions in response to like being traumatized.
Right.
And I don't know. I think it probably does a lot of the opposite things. Like when you take SSRIs, a lot of the bad effects are supposedly related to the 2C receptor. And I think 1A, 2A, and 2C, I think they all are connected in some way that is like regulating trauma learning, reward learning, like trauma learning, all that kind of stuff. Like how strong emotions are maybe too.
Yeah. So with that 5-HT2C receptor, is that one of those weird ones where both agonism and antagonism can downregulate? Is that right? Or is it's a bit
more, I think so, yeah. I think it is like that too. Mm. I don't know studies on the top of my head, but from what I could remember, yeah, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, so that means that for potentially if we are able to find natural substances, or I know there are many pharmacological interventions to antagonize that 2C receptor. A good example is cyproheptadine, because that's a bit of a broad spectrum anti-serotonin agent. But from what I've understood about that receptor is that even antagonism of that 2C receptor can actually increase dopamine release in the prefrontal cortex. And I think you discussed that briefly in the Discord forum at one stage.
Hmm. So you said the 2C receptor, right?
Yeah. Yep.
Okay. I think the stimulation of that receptor suppresses dopamine release.
Yeah.
And it's kind of interesting. Like I haven't confirmed this part yet, but so it releases this corticopterin releasing hormone or something. It's like CRH. I usually just use the abbreviation.
Yeah. Corticotropin releasing hormone, I think.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. And so that stuff stimulates dynorphin release. And both of them are they're both necessary cofactors for experiencing like what seems to be like just negative feeling in general, like things feeling bad. And so it's kind of interesting that like the 2C receptor is like probably increases dynorphin, but the studies that were on LSD, they showed that like kappa opioid receptor and like dynorphin are attenuated, like decreased by acute use of LSD and also long-term redosing of it. And that's only like one study though. So that's like it's kind of weird. It's like not like we definitely need like more evidence for that whole part of it. Yeah. So what do you think?
Yeah. Maybe we can sort of segue into a little bit on the NMDA receptor system, because that is obviously discussed a lot in the context of magnesium supplementation. And a lot of my audience will be using magnesium. So maybe we can talk about how magnesium acts as a very mild NMDA antagonist and sort of how that influences calcium influx, and then also why the whole NMDA system exists. Like what is the NMDA system?
So NMDA receptors are glutamate receptors and they're pretty popular in the brain. I don't know specifically like how popular. I've heard something like 50% of neurons though. Yeah. So it's like a hugely central mechanism to a lot of things. And so it is a calcium channel, and magnesium normally kind of guards the gate of that receptor basically. And if you basically like other glutamate receptors, like the AMPA receptor, when that gets like stimulated enough, the magnesium can be like dislodged from blocking NMDA, and then that allows glutamate into the NMDA to be activated by calcium, I mean, that lets the calcium enter the cell. And so there's like so many interesting things about this receptor. It's like one of my favorite topics. It is the receptor that ketamine blocks and probably how it produces the majority of its effects. And its effects are pretty crazy compared to like if you take like something like a dopamine agonist, it's like, I don't know, you get motivated, but it's not really that crazy usually. Like maybe if you take like a crazy amount, I don't know. But with ketamine, you like completely lose your sense of reality. You hallucinate. You kind of can't figure out how to operate your body at certain doses and stuff like that. So it's like really significant. And so magnesium, if you take that, it would be kind of decreasing stimulation of the NMDA receptor, especially like protecting against excitotoxicity, which like NMDA receptors are kind of the main, as far as I can tell, they're pretty much the main mechanism for brain damage, like just across the board, pretty much. Yeah. Like if you get a stroke, if you have seizures, like probably concussions, like even the mechanisms of just like many other systems, probably even like coronavirus, for example, is probably stimulating NMDA receptors to induce brain damage and stuff like that. So probably magnesium would probably be a good thing to be taking right now, I'm guessing. I mean, I'm not a doctor. I won't say that with like absolute certainty, especially because this is such a new thing.
Yeah.
And NMDA receptors, the thing that's different, at least this is what I think is the most important difference between like an NMDA receptor and other glutamate receptors. I think it's that like most of the glutamate, or at least the other common glutamate receptor, AMPA receptors, they're very like short acting and short firing, like they turn on and off really quick. Whereas the NMDA receptor is turning on much longer. And like my own hypothesis about this is that like if you like take a light in the dark and you like put it in front of your eyes and it like trails, I think that's because of NMDA receptors. Like, I'm not super positive. That's something I actually really want to test. And I'm kind of building an experiment right now in university that's kind of about that topic. But I think, like, a lot of different aspects of, like, perception and cognition and, like, working memory are related to this receptor, the NMDA receptor. I think it kind of, like, stains your brain activity longer in a sense, so that like it's kind of acting as a like a short-term memory on that level.
Right.
And it also, the activation of it enhances like long-term potentiation, which is like a much more like long acting sensitivity to the cells. Like if you reach long-term potentiation, it basically means that those neurons are more sensitive in the future to be activated. So like part of learning would be kind of that you, the more that you like repeat something, for example, you would eventually potentiate like a whole system of neurons, like a whole network of them, so that like all these different pathways and things are kind of like highlighted. So like the next time you go to do that thing, it is like more sensitive than anything else you could do. Like if you learn that something is the right answer, that answer becomes more sensitive compared to just like random arbitrary noise or like, yeah. So maybe you could ask more questions to direct this.
Yeah, sure, sure. So with we'll sort of go back onto like the magnesium, and that's influencing the NMDA receptor, but also we have other minerals as well. So we have zinc that can also influence that calcium channel, and then also glycine as well, because I know a lot of people are supplementing with glycine, and I'm actually someone who, if I take glycine, I'll wake up the next day actually feeling a bit spacey or like a bit depersonalized. And so I'm trying to understand that a little bit more, like to figure out how that's causing that sort of spacey sort of feeling. It sort of feels like there's a bit of a, like a heaviness in the head. It's a pretty bizarre. I know a lot of other people have actually experienced that. My older brother has also experienced that as well. So how does glycine, because I know that glycine interacts with the NMDA receptor, is potentially a co-agonist at that receptor. Yeah.
So glycine is needed for NMDA receptor activity. Like if you didn't have any, you wouldn't be able to get any NMDA receptor activity, I'm pretty sure. Yeah, the stuff you mentioned, glycine is another interesting point, like the way that people react to it, especially because, like, for example, like a lot of glycine type drugs are used to treat schizophrenia, but the side effects are basically like manic symptoms. And so like I'll often use that kind of distinction to kind of show that like bipolar and, or at least manic and like psychotic type states are not really the same. There's probably like, they're probably like, I think manic is like psychedelic pretty much, whereas like psychotic might be more like salvia or dissociative. And glycine seems to treat like the dissociative problems with like schizophrenia. And like my own reaction, I don't know, like I've been taking theanine, which is like really popular. I loved it. I'm kind of like mixed on it right now, to be honest, because I swear I think I've gotten like withdrawal symptoms from it, which is like...
At what like dose? Just,
it was like probably... like I was using Soylent, which the cafe Soylent has 75 milligrams of theanine. And I was also taking it at night in a powder form and stuff to sleep. I mean, there was like other factors, I think, because I was taking like magnesium glycinate. There was like other stuff. I don't remember everything, but like I was like eating for like fermented foods, which are like GABA. There's GABA in it sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah. I think a lot of people underestimate the influence of these, the psychobiotic effect of these fermented foods. I mean, I'm someone I mean, they're some of them are really powerful. And the thing about them is that they can be very delayed as well in their effects. Like from my experience with certain like sauerkraut mixes, they can have a very delayed effect on check. Like realistically, they've influenced the way I think. Like just some of the thought patterns are just very different. But yeah, these, are you similar in that regard with some of these like fermented foods?
Totally. Like even when this started, like basically what happened, like I was making this ramen with, it was ghost pepper ramen with like this fermented tofu, which is intensely flavorful. It's made with like some kind of yeast, I think. So it's not a bacterial probiotic or whatever. And then I was mixing kimchi into it. And I did this like 3 days in a row. And then after that, I woke up like having hot flashes and freaking out. And then like, I don't know, like I stopped theanine. I stopped like eating the ramen. I stopped eating spicy food. And like I felt honestly kind of traumatized by whatever that was. And like, I don't know, I've had other weird experiences. Like, my friend made homemade kimchi. And I, man, that's like the sketchiest thing, I feel like. Like, I know a lot of people are doing that. I think, like, you really have to, like, make sure you wash your hands and, like, do everything right when you're, like, preparing it. Mm. But, like, we would eat this stuff. And, like, there would be, like, visual effects, like, I swear. It's, like we would eat it, and then, like, 30 minutes later, everything looks kind of glowy. And, like, I don't know if we ever had aniracetam, but it's...
Yeah.
It's, like, pretty much like that. Mm. And I don't know, there was, like, other effects. Like, honestly, it would change day to day. The flavor would change day to day. And whatever it did would change day to day. And that just, like, kind of... like freaked me out, and I didn't eat it after that because I don't know, like some of the symptoms were getting weird. Mm. And yeah, I think, I don't know, like I feel like you can get like a huge range of effects from probiotics. Like I consider them psychoactive pretty much. 100%.
What with the kimchi and the sauerkraut fermented foods, what do you suspect? I mean, I've got my theories as to why they or how they're acting, but have you delved into any research in relation to it? You know, we know that it's going to be affecting the serotonin receptors in the gut, but is there anything else that sort of stood out or that you'd like to research a little bit more?
Yeah, they have like, so they do have just actual GABA in them. Like that's usually a byproduct of the bacteria. There's stuff like tyramine.
Yeah.
Tyramine is weird. Like, and I'm pretty sensitive to tyramine. Like, yeah. If I eat chocolate, I tend to get migraines, which sucks. And like, sometimes it won't even be pain. It's like just visual effects. And that's like even weirder. Like I'll go blind in just like half my eye or something. And, even stuff like that, like, I feel like migraine auras and seizure auras, I feel like that you could pretty much just describe that as like folk, like how there's like focal seizures. I feel like this is like focal psychedelia. It's just like a trip and just like one little section of your brain is like freaking out, or like just half your eyes like tripping balls or something. But there's GABA, there's also MSG
in and a lot of these things. Fermented cabbage, things like that.
Yeah, wow. Like, I don't know about kimchi. I know there's glutamate and glutamine, yeah. Probably. With, like, the fermented tofu, I'm pretty sure that had MSG. I think soy sauce is technically a fermented food, and that's got MSG for sure. I don't remember others. I think even, like, some cheeses, like, I think blue cheese might have had MSG in it, too. But yeah, a lot of people think MSG is not active. I think it totally is, but I think it depends. Like when I've eaten MSG on an empty stomach, like a bunch of it, like one time I was at my job and I just ate like a bunch of Chex Mix on an empty stomach. And then when I'm driving, I thought I had chest pain, but then like what I realized is it was my seatbelt, like the pressure of my seatbelt on my skin felt like super thick and heavy. And it's like, I don't know. And that kind of like fits into what I think, because it's an NMDA receptor stimulating chemical.
Yeah.
MSG is. And kind of like fits into the whole like theory of what the receptors are doing. Like if blocking the receptor, like with ketamine or PCP is, anesthesia, then maybe this is exactly the opposite of anesthesia, which might be why it's so great for taste, because maybe it's like just making us extremely sensitive to our taste.
Is that part of potentially how it's like reinforcing and potentially addictive in that nature, potentially?
Yeah, I think so. So that is super interesting that you've said that, because NMDA receptors are studied in addiction. And I never actually linked that to the MSG thing, though, which is totally addictive too.
Yeah.
NMDA, the way I think of the NMDA receptors in terms of like addiction, I think that when you, like, if you were to mix it, if you were to mix like even theanine, yeah. I think if you mix it with doing something else, I think you might be really sensitive at first. Like, I feel like it's like just exposing your senses and your feelings to that experience, but then you'll quickly adapt much faster. Like in the same way that like more like significant events, kind of like imprint into your memory harder, or like more emotional events kind of stick into your memory much more than like arbitrary, random, nothing, like just arbitrary events.
Yeah.
I think it's kind of like enhancing acutely, but in the long term, I think it's going to produce tolerance much faster. And then like there's like research showing if you block this receptor, you can actually prevent tolerance yeah. and even reverse it, which is yeah. really interesting.
That's part of how a lot of people have been discussing agmatine in that regard for potentiating opioids. It's definitely a compound I need to get more familiar with, because I haven't really experimented with agmatine for many years now. So maybe we can sort of segue into a little bit on caffeine and nicotine, because I know these are ubiquitous. So maybe we can talk a little bit about what sort of maybe like the addictive nature, or like what makes these stimulants so depleting in a sense.
So with nicotine, there is like the mechanisms of nicotine that enhance cognitive ability, those ones link up to the NMDA receptor. They also are supposed to suppress dynorphin activity.
Wow.
But the thing that we see is that when people do nicotine a lot, like repeated doses makes you really sensitive to dynorphin in the kappa opioid system.
Wow.
Like, I actually think that that is, like, people talk about schizophrenia and like how like a huge amount of them smoke and use nicotine. And like a lot of researchers used to say that it's because of the cognitive enhancing effects. And I do think that in some sense that is true, but I think that that's like an acute effect. And I think it becomes even more acute the more that you use it. And like, I've kind of written about this a little bit before. I actually think that nicotine could be like one of the factors that is a risk for schizophrenia. Like, I think it could be that you're basically like making yourself really sensitive to dynorphin, which is kind of supposed to be, it's kind of supposed to be the withdrawal effects, supposedly, of like a lot of drugs like cocaine, stimulants, morphine, nicotine. Like, the withdrawals are like enhanced dynorphin activity, which makes you like anhedonic, lazy, dysphoric, maybe anxious, afraid. And so I didn't mention this before, but the way that I think you could view like the whole association of dynorphin and schizophrenia, it's kind of like, so dynorphin is basically a stress hormone for the most part. And I think its role is to kind of teach you not to do things. Like if you touch something and it burns, I think part of the pain reaction that you have is dynorphin and like substance P and a bunch of stuff. But the dynorphin part of it, I think, is the part that's like saying like, no, don't do that again.
Yeah.
And it kind of like scars your memory so that you're like you'll just anticipate suffering the next time you see that stimuli. And with like if you think about that in terms of like schizophrenia, I think it's pretty much that the schizophrenics are like so sensitive to stress, or that they've experienced so much stress because of their environment, or both. Probably usually both. It probably needs a little bit of both for you to get that bad. Although it's debatable, I guess. But it's like if you're so stressed out enough that you begin to get like hallucinogenic salvia type effects from stress. And I do think that you can get it even if you're not schizophrenic. Like, I don't think you have to necessarily have genes that make you sensitive to hallucinating because of stress. Like, there's like some research on solitary confinement. Oh, yeah, I love that stuff. It's interesting.
That's crazy. It's sad. They can induce schizophrenia by keeping people confined in a small space, right? What was that study exactly?
So I think that there's like a couple different ones that talk about this. I think that they're actually observing people that are imprisoned. I think some of them might be psych hospitals where like a patient might have gone in with things like not so severe. And then they end up getting like really schizophrenic when they're like locked in a bedroom 24/7 and supposedly being treated
in lockdown, right?
Yeah, in coronavirus lockdown. Yeah. I'm just kidding. And then people start talking about like the 5G and all that.
Yeah, which potentially would influence the NMDA.
That's really interesting and scary. Like, even like, I'm pretty sure 4G even does that. That's weird. Like, it's weird that they dismiss that. Like, people dismiss it with MSG, and now they'll dismiss it with 5G. It's funny. MSG, 5G, it's funny.
Yeah.
I think there was something that we went off tangent with, like the stress and the, I think it was addiction. So I think with nicotine, you're kind of like, a lot of people are probably like, they might start off just using it because for whatever reason, maybe they were curious, maybe being curious about using nicotine is like a risk factor. And then like you become like you find it helps with like stress, then you start to notice that you become less able to handle stress without it, then it gets like just like escalating effects. Like every time it wears off, you're getting like, you're linking the withdrawal effects to like everything around you. Like maybe you like have one day at your job where you're like coping with stress and you smoke more, and then it kind of like bleeds over where like you get withdrawal effects from increasing your use, and then it's like a normal day and you're having those withdrawal effects, and now that day is like stressful all of a sudden, and then it just kind of like goes down a rabbit hole where you're coping with the withdrawal symptoms basically. And I think a lot of people with schizophrenia are actually doing this. I think that like there was like one study that said 80% of like, it was like, I think it was like 80 to 90% of people with schizophrenia smokes cigarettes.
Wow.
Yeah. And it's like pretty crazy. It's like they rationalize that they might be self-medicating, but it's like, come on. Like,
yeah,
that's such a huge percentage. Like, why isn't there like a lot of, Like you're pretty much saying that it's really rare for a schizophrenic person to not use nicotine. That's just so sketchy.
Yeah.
But I mean, I think there's truth to it. Like, I do think it would increase cognition acutely and help. But and you mentioned like other drugs. Like, I don't remember. You said nicotine and like other things.
Nicotine and caffeine as well, because they're obviously similar alkaloids. And commonly used as well. But let's maybe with caffeine, and I know it influences nicotine's excretion and also its pharmacokinetics and things like that. But with caffeine withdrawal, for example, which I believe develops, well, tolerance develops rapidly. I think within potentially, 2 to 3 days for most people, you know, tolerance starts to kick in. But the whole withdrawal process, what do you think, apart from its effects on the adenosine system, what else do you think is playing a role in its, like, withdrawal-like symptoms?
So with caffeine, it's probably, there's probably definitely dynorphin activity involved there too. Like pretty much any drug that stimulates dopamine or glutamate has the potential of increasing dynorphin activity. I think it's like basically like a response to try to control any kind of toxicity, pretty much, like, cause like seizures will like stimulate a bunch of like glutamate. Like it's kind of like a glutamate storm, and then dynorphin comes in and it actually suppresses seizures. Like you could administer dynorphin as an anticonvulsant. And it can be neuroprotective, but it's really tricky. It's also able to be neurotoxic. So like when people do drugs, it's probably like if it's like any kind of super normal stimulus that probably on most systems, think of NMDA receptors and is being involved in like learning, it's probably like the tolerance to all these different systems and like just having your body learn to react to your environment or whatever stimuli, like just in general, is probably going to stimulate that mechanism. Like everything in our life, we just kind of adapt and get numb to, I feel like. And probably, I don't know, but that's kind of like going on a tangent. But like with caffeine, caffeine's kind of interesting too. Like there's mechanisms in it. I think it's through the adenosine mechanism that suppresses NMDA receptor activity.
Right.
And so like if you take a lot of it, you can probably get like psychotic effects. I think there was one study recently that said it was only like 3 cups of coffee that are necessary before people start experiencing like different checklist symptoms of psychotic symptoms, like probably paranoia is probably what comes first. Or like anxiety or whatever.
Very interesting. All right, well, we're getting near to the end. So, I mean, the reason why I really wanted to get you onto the show was to help people understand their brains a little bit better, because that's ultimately what I'm all about. And to get people like yourself to discuss and brainstorm ideas in regards to hacking the brain, because I really want to give people the tools and the knowledge that they need to understand their own neurochemistry and then ultimately take control of that. Because I do believe that we as humans can definitely, you know, we can influence our thoughts and our behaviors through different methods, through sauna use, through supplementation, through exercise, through diet. We've spoken about sauerkraut now. There's so many different systems and different inputs that can influence how we feel. So we've got a minute remaining on this IGTV. So maybe we'll just finish off by giving my listeners a chance for them to find you and your content. Do you want to just let them know your socials?
Sure. Yeah. I think you can probably click on my Instagram already, I'm guessing. It's Quirky Science on there. It's Q-W-E-R-K-Y Science. And for Twitter, it's at Basic Morality, which is kind of sounds irrelevant, but that's what it happens to be. So, and then for my blog, that is pretty much like probably the most important thing. It is mad.science.blog. And I basically post a bunch of essays there and I cite everything that's like intense literature reviews about just like a lot of topics about neurochemistry, sometimes philosophy, and different stuff like that. And I do want to say sorry if it was like a bit chaotic. I am like sleep deprived and kind of like having some weird things going on at the same time. So it's a bit scatterbrained in ADHD.
Thank you everyone for joining in to today's episode. For in-depth show notes and lessons learned, visit nofilter.media/boostyourbiology.
This has been a No Filter Media production.
Say what you want.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.